This is Ranger Kidwell Ross, editor at worldsweeper.com, and we're speaking with Giselle Chapman, and Giselle is principal with Chapman Business Solutions. Giselle was a presenter at National Pavement Expo 2010 here in Nashville, which is where we're holding this interview. This particular seminar that Giselle put on was called Time-Saving Solutions for Managing Your Electronic Office, and there are a number of tips that you will find absolutely must-have that will come out of this conversation with Giselle. I think we'd all agree that we've heard many times and would agree with the fact that time is money, and more so these days than any other time. We'd also intellectually be in agreement that the better we manage your time, the more time we'll have, whether it's to become more profitable, to have extra time with clients, to make more money in our business, to have time with our family. One of the things that Giselle brings up is the concept of time thieves, and I think at that point I'll let her take it away because she has just a number of useful takeaway ideas for how you can manage your electronic office better, smoother, and be more productive. So Giselle, thanks again for joining us, and take it away.
Well, Ranger, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here at the National Pavement Expo. And as you said, time is such a precious commodity, and time is certainly something that you never give back. We think about budgeting our money, but we don't really think about budgeting our time. And so what I promised the participants at the workshop was that they would be able to gain a work week back per year with following some of these techniques. And so what I'm going to do is really just share some of the major time thieves, as you have said, because if we know what the cause of our time being eroded is, then we can do something about it. And the three big ones are really, in today's society, email takes up a huge chunk of time. We're going to talk a little bit more about how much time it actually takes up. Then we're going to take a look at finding and filing information. Typical professionals spend 30% of their day finding and filing information. So if we can do something to get them some time back there, we'll bring back a lot of time in their day. And the last thing are interruptions, whether it's firefighting interruptions, whether it's telephone interruptions, or it's email interruptions. Interruptions in general are huge time consumers. So I thought we'd start out with the one that really consumes a lot of people's time, and that's email. People say, oh, you know, when I look at it on a daily basis, you know, maybe I get 30 to 50 emails. Well, what studies have shown on average is most professionals get about 50 emails per day. If you look at it over a yearly basis, considering you take 2 weeks for vacation, 50 emails a day adds up to 12,000 emails per professional. You're spending 2 minutes on those emails. The math adds up that you are actually spending 50 workdays per year on email. Let me say that again. 50 workdays a year on just email. So if we can gain you any time back in just that one factor, we can bring a lot of time back into your life. And so what I wanted to really talk about are some things that you can do to decrease the volume of email that you get first. So a couple things that we're going to take a look at is what can you do to do that? One thing that you can do to decrease email volume is minimize the reply to all. Studies have been shown in almost 900 participants that the number one irritant that other people do with them for email is hit reply to all. That sends out a tremendous amount of emails that people don't want. Where does that typically come up? It comes up if people are really used in a distribution list. So somebody sends out an email to a distribution list, and somebody says thank you and hits reply to all. Everyone on that distribution list gets that thank you, and they didn't need it. When you get something from a distribution list, a rule of thumb to use is just reply so that it only goes back to the sender. As a sender, having on the email that you're going to use a distribution list, if you reply back to this email, reply back to me only. So that right at the top so reminds people, don't just hit reply to all, because now all of a sudden it starts this stream of emails that makes people insane. So that's a huge one. Don't use reply to all unless necessary. The number two thing is no reply needed. Now, when you're setting up policies like this within your office, I recommend that you roll it out to your team and let them know. We found some tips to be able to save you time on email. So we're going to put a couple things in place so that you understand that when I send you this, it's not an offensive thing, but it's just to really save you time. So when you're sending an email out to someone and that you don't need a reply, right at the top of the email, no reply needed. so that they know, right? Again, this is just FYI, so it's information for me, but I don't need to send the, you know, trivial thank you back to someone. And so along the lines of that trivial thank you, if you're sending something where somebody might not reply, but they would feel like, oh, I want to reply back to you, Ranger, you sent it to me, let me thank you. If it's for a routine thing, I would just write at the top of my email again, no thank you needed, and it lets the recipient then feel good about, okay, this is just something that Ranger wanted me to hear, and I don't need to reply back to that. He appreciates it, because each one of these emails is an interruption. And so if we can decrease the interruptions in someone's day, we save them a tremendous amount of time. We're going to talk about interruptions a little bit more.
And that might be even a better thank you than having to read your thank you.
You got that right. I mean, how many times have you been in deep thought, and then all of a sudden your email hover comes up, and it's just somebody saying thank you, and all now you've got to try to get yourself refocused back on it. So you're absolutely
right. And you have to consider whether you say, whether you reply to them and say, just trying to keep you in the loop. In which case, they come back and say, well, thanks a lot for that.
Do I send the thank you card for my thank you card?
That's right. Excellent point, Giselle.
So the number four thing that you can do to save yourself the volume of emails is by sending less, you get less. For every 5 emails that you send out, you get 3 emails back. So if you can decrease just 1 in 5 emails that you send, you reduce your email volume by 12%. And when you're looking at, you know, 12,000 emails a year, reducing that by 12% is a significant amount of time given back to you. So simply reducing 1 in 5 will do that. A couple of other things that I really want to talk about is people will say, well, Giselle, if you want me to send less emails, how do I know which ones to send? I ask myself the question, EAT before you send. And EAT is an acronym. The E in EAT stands for, is it essential? Does this email need to be sent? The A in EAT stands for, is this appropriate? Is this in line with compliance of our company's guidelines on email? And also, is it compliant with regulatory things that will go out? You know, you really want to make sure that if you read this on the cover of the Wall Street Journal with your name on it, would you want that email sent? So anything offensive, anything like that, you want to be careful of. And the T in EAT stands for, is it targeted at the right audience? Are the right stakeholders in? If you are an owner of a company, you send an email out to everyone in the organization about a real specific topic that's for your management team, you're going to be getting email questions back because people don't really understand the content and they're trying to clarify and they want to look important to you. You get a whole different reasons that people will reply, but it's unwanted email. So be clear on who those stakeholders are. So the question again to ask before you send an email is EAT, is it essential, appropriate, and targeted at the right audience? That will really help you to choose of the emails that you do send. But now when you decide to send an email, if the quality of the email is better, it will also help to decrease the amount of emails that you do. So the first thing that I work on is, now Ranger, have you ever received an email with a subject line either blank or just saying RE?
I detest it.
It's just wasted space, right? It's
like and I'd take it even further than that to say that I've sent them an email about a targeted thing, and now they come back to me 5 days later on a completely unrelated topic. They can't remember my email, so they go find the one I sent them, and they don't change the subject line, and it's sent out to 5 other people. And now there's a discussion that ensues, and all of the emails back and forth have the wrong subject line in it.
Ranger, I am so glad you brought that up. I was talking about just the blank ones, but your point is even stronger because what happens is the whole subject line is so that we can search later and be able to relate to what this topic is. And if it has no information, or like you described, the wrong information, it doesn't help us at all. And so I want to talk with you about a tool that you can utilize to make your subject line really strong and that information is valuable. And the acronym that I use to really make my subject line robust is called ICAT, and it's I-C-A-T. The I-C-A-T refers to the 4 reasons that people send an email. So people will send you an email because of the I, they want to inform you of something, share information. The C is because they want to consult you about something, they want to ask you a question. The A is because they want to set an appointment with you. So they want to schedule something with you. And the T in ICAT stands for they want to give you a to-do or a task. So they want to give you either a project or a task. So the ICAP stands for that. So to recap what ICAT stands for, the four reasons that people will send you an email is to I, inform you, C, consult you, A, to set an appointment with you, and T is to give you a to-do. So ICAT, inform, consult, appointment, or to-do.
Very good.
So Ranger, the next thing that I really want to talk with you about is we talked about improving the subject line of your email, is improving the body of your email. Have you ever received an email where it's a whole page long, but you don't know why the sender sent it to you? They haven't asked you to do anything. It's just a lot of text. And so a couple of things that I say is suggest to people when creating email is, one, first of all, try to do it on just one topic and have it fit in the preview panel of the email, because people do not want to scroll down and see a bunch of things. If you have multiple topics, people say, oh, I sent you three things, and then you didn't respond back to it. People's attention span is very short, so keep it to one topic, and I'm going to give you 3 points to help you do that. If you have in your email, utilize GAS, give your email GAS before you send. The G stands for let the sender know the goal of why you're sending it. In one sentence, this is why I'm sending it to you. The A in GAS stands for what action do I want the recipient to take as a result of this email? And the S is for what support material is there. If I send you an attachment and it's several attachments in there, you're not going to know what I specifically want you to read. So I would say, Ranger, can you look at page 13 of the Word document and then look at the Excel sheet and let me know what you think of page 3 in that so that I can get your thoughts on these numbers and the document that was written there. So it's very specific about what the support material that's given to you and what action that I want you to take with it. So remember, give the body of your email GAS before you send. The goal, the action, and the support material that you give them. So these are just a few things that will help you to minimize your email volume. If you have good quality emails, you're not sending unnecessary emails, it will really help you out tremendously. Now, there's a couple of other things around emails that are emails or texting or internet that people will always ask me questions about, and it's around netiquette. And I say that netiquette is really email etiquette or texting etiquette. One of the things that people will tend to do is because they've been doing a lot of texting now, is in email start to use some acronyms. For example, you'll see LOL in an email. Well, remember, this is still a business correspondence, so you want it to be professional. If you start writing LOL or OMG, people start to look and say, wow, you know, Ranger's really not that professional. He's sending me these things with these little acronyms in there. That doesn't really feel good. So be careful when you're writing an email to make sure that you still keep normal business language and your business writing and the way that you do that. Other things that you want to avoid is using crazy fonts in emails. You know, some people say, oh, I want to put my own stationery in there and all these things. Well, when you send somebody something with your stationery, when they go to reply to it, a lot of times the stationery will duplicate. It makes a dark background that they can't read on. It may be in fonts and things that they can't do. They don't have on their computer, so it makes it very frustrating when they're trying to reply back to you. Along those same lines, if you send your logo in an email, that may be an attachment that's very frustrating to people. Their spam filter may kick it out. They may not even get the email. So you really want to keep it simple and really just have the pertinent information in there. It's fine to have an email signature with your company name and what your contact information is, but keep it as simple as that, really what the sender would need to get back in touch with you. So that's a key thing. Now, Ranger, I know you had some questions around some different email things. What were some of the things that stuck out in your mind?
Well, I know one of the things that I see a lot of times are, it appears to be a confusion between when to put somebody into the to line and when to put them into the carbon copy line and what a BCC line is and what that might be used, which stands for blind carbon copy. Can you talk about that a minute?
No, that's an excellent point. If you're addressing an email that is specifically to one person, but you want a couple of other people to be informed on it, I would say that in the subject line, who the email is to is the only person that should be in the subject line. In the CC line or carbon copy line would be people who it's for your reference. I would recommend using the carbon copy as opposed to the BCC. The BCC would be a rare occasion if you've got, say, like an HR issue or something like that where you really need to keep that, that somebody blind carbon copied on it. But I think in terms of establishing relationships, if you blind carbon copy someone on something, it really is not letting the sender know that somebody else has been shared, that information has been shared. And when they reply to your email, it's going to reply also to the people who have been blind carbon copied. So it's really not fair to send that to someone unless you've got a very specific business reason of not letting someone know that someone else has been copied on that. So you really want to be careful with that BCCing someone. Unless it's absolutely a business-specific purpose, I would not use the BCC. Now, sometimes the people will try to use BCC because they want to send it out to a distribution list that you don't want everybody to see it. You can use an undisclosed distribution list. There's tools within your email management system that allow you to blind who the recipients are without allowing each person to get that response back to you. So you do want to be careful with when to use BCC.
Mm-hmm. But it is invaluable in some HR issues and that sort of thing, too. So it is definitely worth looking into what a BCC is if you're in the business of having employees and so forth. One other question I guess I'd have. I see once in a while people don't realize the netiquette of typing everything in capital letters.
That's a great point. You know, sometimes people say, oh, you know, I can't read it when it's smaller, because typically the default font is like a size 10 font in emails. So people will type in all caps just because they want to make it easier to read. You can adjust the font size to make it bigger without doing all caps, because when you type in all caps in email, that means you're yelling at someone. And so you really want to watch typing in all caps and also inappropriate use of punctuations. If you put a bunch of punctuations together, that also connotes screaming in email. You know, we use emoticons where people use, you know, make a little smiley face and things like that. Well, what the connotation is from the all caps or inappropriate punctuation can mean screaming. So be careful that you're not typing in proper, using upper and lowercase and regular business language.
Perfect.
So then we're going to move to the next time thief, really looking at filing and finding information. I don't know, everybody uses different folder systems and things like that of filing it. A lot of times they'll use My Documents to capture all their information, and they'll just be an abyss of folders. And when they're trying to look for something, they just can't find the information that they need. So they're searching and searching and searching, using all different types of search criteria to try to find it. But the easiest thing would be able to have a system that was intuitive that allowed them to know where the information was, as opposed to trying to have to figure out how I filed it. It's almost like if you have a place at your house where you put a key holder and you set your keys there, so each time that you want to find your keys, you know where they are. Well, I've created an intuitive system that allows people to organize their information based on how they deal with people. And it's, I use three different P's that I do. I say you always deal with people. So people or clients are one intuitive bucket that I file my information in. The second intuitive bucket is to look at products or service. People use products or service, so you want products and services. And the third intuitive bucket is the paper bucket. So anytime you use a product or a service, you want to do something about people, you always have this paper trail. And I say that's the administrative things. That's going to be your largest group of information that's stored. So, you know, if you have expense reports, budgets, travel, just anything that falls outside of people or products and service would fall into those big buckets. Now, I also do subfolders under that. But the beautiful thing about having that three intuitive groups, people, products and service, and paper, if you're going to look for something, it's only going to be in three places. And so you'll know, that was related to one of my clients. That'll definitely be under people, so I would find it there. Oh, that was a meeting agenda. Oh, that would be under paper. That's an administrative thing, so I would know to look intuitively under there. So people say, Giselle, well, what would the subgroups look, the subfolders look like under those three Ps? Well, under the people folder or clients, I do it based on how I touch them. So I do my active folder for people that I touch 30 days or less are my active. My inactive folder are people who are any more than 30 days, so 31 days or greater. Then I also have a folder for teams. You know, I'm part of NAPSA. I'm part of any type of association or group I would keep under my teams. And then the last is for people you're prospecting. Any person who you see that has a potential to be a client but is not a client yet would go under your prospect. So under your subgroups for your people folder would be your inactive, your active, your teams, and your prospects. So those would be the four that would go under there. Then if you go to your next group, which are your products and services, I keep it under three simple categories: products or service I sell, products or service I use, and products or service that are competitors. So under the products and services, ones that I sell, ones that I use, or competitors. So now we're going to drop down to that third intuitive bucket, which is paper. And again, paper is any administrative task. This is going to be your largest group of folders. Anything that does not fit under your other two will go here. So expense reports, budgets, all those type of things would be in file folders under here. But the nice thing is that the system is so intuitive. Anyone in my office, I could say, could you get me the agenda from XY meeting? I don't have to tell them where it's filed. They know intuitively where to find it. So the wonderful thing is whether you're in the office or you're looking for it, anyone can find that where the information is stored. So to decrease that 35% of time that people are spending on filing and finding information to a smaller number, and again, getting you back to our ultimate goal to get you more time back and get that work week a year back to you.
Well, that's a great explanation. I haven't heard anything with that clarity before.
Thank you, Ranger. So the next area that I really want to talk about in terms of getting time back in your day is around interruptions. There are many interruptions. Email is certainly one of them. You know, it's really funny because the email makers, right, they do it to save us time, but their default application actually comes with lots of alerts and bells and whistles to distract us. When you get an email, a noise sounds off, and then you get the little hover of you can read part of the mail, and then the other thing that you'll get is a little envelope, and then the cursor changes. You've got four things to alert you to tell you an email has arrived, just to say you've got mail. My recommendation is the first thing that you do is go into your email options and turn all of those off. Those can all four be unchecked and simply removed. And that will save you a tremendous amount of time. Now, people say to me, well, you know, a quick little interruption, it's nice to know coming in there. But they don't realize how much time that is wasted with interruptions. For each interruption, it takes from 6 to 9 minutes for the interruption to be dealt with. And then for you now to get refocused back on what you were thinking about, it takes you anywhere from 4 to 5 minutes to get back on. So each interruption in your day costs you anywhere from 10 to 14 minutes. 5 interruptions in a day is an hour wasted.
Well, that's enormous.
You know, so anything that we can do to minimize that would really save us a tremendous amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Another big interrupter is our telephone. So I've come up with some strategies that will really help, and I can tell you these are not original strategies. You read anything on time management, and they will really help you in terms of organizing this. But one of the things I recommend that everyone has in their office is a speakerphone. Because have you ever made a phone call and you get into somebody's business loop where, you know, you've got a bunch of different prompts that you have to hit? It's common in today's. It's rare that we actually get a person when you call. So having a speakerphone allows you to be into a system like that where you're on a prompt and still allows you to be doing work behind the scenes. And also a lot of times we're put on hold, you know. Your call is very important to me. It'll be 10 minutes before we can get to you. So during that 10 minutes, if you have a speakerphone, you're able to still continue to work. I also recommend that your speakerphone has a timer on it. Reason being is one of the things that people really appreciate is if you respect their time. If I call you and say, hey, Ranger, you know, do you have 5 minutes? And you say yes, and I take 10, the next time I ask you for 5 minutes, you're not going to want to give it to me.
Well, you've already given it to me the last time. So I'll say, well, I gave him that other 5 minutes before.
It's done.
We're done. So I understand. I understand completely. And I'd add in, you probably would be getting to this anyway, but I have become relatively married to my Bluetooth headset when it comes to a cell phone. That makes such a difference, too, because you still have both of your hands to do whatever it is you were doing with them when the phone rang, adding that part in, too. I think that people tend to apologize that they're on a speakerphone, but sometimes it does make a lot more sense. But, of course, if there's somebody else in the room, that's a terrible etiquette breach, is if there's somebody else in the room listening. And I think we've probably all had that at one point or another, we're 10 minutes into a conversation, and then they say, well, here, let me ask Bill. He's standing right here. And maybe you were talking about Bill, or, you know, you were going to and didn't know that he was there. So if there is somebody else in the room, you're on a speakerphone with somebody, do identify them.
You're absolutely right, Ranger. And actually, the Bluetooth headphone really solves both problems. It allows you to have the hands free, and it allows you to be on hold and not do something. So that's really a perfect resolution. And I think, like you said, you know, if somebody else is in the room, it's like blind carbon copying somebody without letting them know. You don't want to hurt your relationship by not being upfront about what's going on and letting them know the situation. And you can hear when you're on speakerphone. So this also avoids the apology that goes along with that.
True enough.
Other tips that you can utilize with your phone is, in order to be able to keep to my 5 minutes, I have to know what I'm talking to you about, right? So I consider a phone call just like any other meeting. So I want to have a plan for what I want to have accomplished and the steps in order to get there. And so by having that plan ahead of time, it allows me to really honor my commitment. So that's one recommendation that I would have for phone calls. Also, bunching your calls together. So I recommend doing phone calls 2 times a day. Do it right before lunch, so I would say between either 11 and 12 or 11:30 to 12:30, so that you can catch people before they leave for lunch, and it also gives them a reason to want to get off the phone because they're heading someplace. The only thing between them and lunch is you, so they're going to be much more efficient and productive on the call with you. The other time of day that I recommend doing calls is in the afternoon between 3:30 and 4:30. People are ready to leave and get home for the afternoon, so they really want to get off. So if you're really effective with that, that's another way to do that. So it gives you an hour block of when you can return your calls. And when you're doing like tasks at the same time, it allows you to be more efficient as well. So that's another thing that tends to help you. The other thing, screen your calls if you can. If you've got somebody who can find out what the call is about and allows you to prepare, it allows you to be much more organized for that person when you get on it. But screening your calls, you want to have somebody give and get callback times. So Ranger would be available to return your call between 11:30 and 12:30 or between 3:30 and 4:30. What time works for you? And so this way, and if none of those times are good, get a specific time when Ranger can call back. So that way it works well. And people appreciate that. Again, if you have a good plan before you get on the phone and how you're going to handle it, it will help to minimize those hours a day that get wasted because of interruptions. We talk about really saving time. People don't want to just be efficient at doing the wrong things. They want to do the most important things to get done. And so I've got a tool that I've learned about, and I actually read about it from Charles Schwab when he was the president of Bethlehem Steel. He actually had an efficiency consultant come in, and he had them work with a tool, and the tool was called the Six Most. And what he had them do is he had them write down the 6 most important things that they needed to get accomplished the next day to move business forward. Had them write it at the end of the day and organize it in priority order. And the next day when they came in, they were to start with number 1 and stay with number 1 until it was complete, and to move down the list in the order of priority. If they didn't complete all the tasks, they would move that on to the next day. And their team was to do this for 30 days. The ironic thing is the efficiency consultant did not charge them anything for the work. He said to Charles Schwab, he said, I don't want you to pay me anything unless this works for your team. If it works for your team, I want you to pay me what you think it's worth. Well, at that time, the people were making about $100 a week. And at the end of 30 days, Charles Schwab wrote Ivy Lee a check for $25,000 because the effectiveness of his leadership team had gone up that much. So I figured if it worked for Charles Schwab and Bethlehem Steel, it certainly could work for me. So I'm using the 6 most today. And there's a couple of other rules that I want to share with you as it relates to the 6 most. Certainly you want to do it at the end of your day. What are the 6 most important things that I want to get accomplished tomorrow? Start with the number 1 most important thing and go down through number 6. For me, I always put the most difficult thing first. You know, as Brian Tracy says, eat the ugliest frog first. So you start with the most difficult thing, go through, start with one, stay with one till you complete it. What I noticed, though, sometimes I would see something showing up on my list 3 days in a row. If you see that, ask yourself the question, is it something that I need help with? Is it something that somebody else should be doing? Or is it really a project and not a task? So I keep the things on my six most to be things that I can accomplish in 60 to 90 minutes the most. If it takes me more than that, I break it up into two tasks. And so that has really helped me to stop things from dragging on and on and on and never moving off my six most. The other thing I do is I put it on color paper so it stands out. And I leave it right there on my desk. If for some reason I had to be out of the office, then somebody can look right away and say, here's the six most important things Giselle was going to get accomplished tomorrow, and look at that and know. And if it was a customer that had to be called or something like that, they would know right away where to begin. So it really is helpful in your team. And the other advantage of doing it the night before is your brain is working on it subconsciously throughout the night and makes you more productive the next day. So that is really focusing on getting those most important things done first. The last area that I really want to talk about that people have challenges with is decluttering. They have so much stuff in their office. It's like, it might not be that I didn't file it right. It may be that I never filed and I've got this stack of to file. So I utilize a tool that I learned from a Jack Canfield workshop called the 4 D's of decluttering. If you get something that comes into your office either electronically through an email or in a piece of paper, the first thing is, if I can do this in 10 minutes or less, do it now. So if it's 10 minutes or less, I do it now. If I receive something and I can get it from another resource, I'm going to dump it. If I can get it from the internet, if I can get it from another person, there's no need for me to keep it, I dump it. If it's something that should go to someone else, then I delegate it right then. And when you delegate something, so that you only have to think about this once, I put a post-it note on it if it's something physical, and I write exactly what I want the person to do and the date and the time that I want it done. Because if I say, Ranger, I need this article proofread, and I say to you, I need it by Thursday, well, that could be Thursday morning or it could be Thursday afternoon. But if I need it Thursday morning, I want to be clear, can I have it Thursday by 10 a.m.? So that gives me plenty of time to be able to do what I need to do on that. So when you're delegating something, you want to really make sure that you have clear instruction for the person that you're delegating it to. And the last of the D's is to delay it. If I'm going to have something that I know that I can't do right now, instead of just leaving it on my desk or leaving it in my inbox, I will put it on my task list and say I want to do it and by what date. And now I don't have to worry that I'm going to forget about it because it's on my task list with a date and a reminder so I know exactly when it's done. So to recap the decluttering, you do it if you can do it in 10 minutes or less. You dump it if it's something that you can get in another resource. You delegate it if someone else should be doing it besides you. And you delay it if it's something that you're not going to be able to handle right now.
Very organized.
Well, you know, what I find is that doing a little bit more work up front saves you a lot more time, gives you a lot more time on the long run. So I learn from other people. None of these things are original, but I learn from people who are consistently getting the results and outcomes that they want. So I think we should probably bring this session to a close with a couple of things of tying everything together. People will say, you know, Giselle, you talk about touching things once. How do you do that? Well, what I do is I'm going to use an email example to do this. When I look at an email for the first time, I decide, what is it that I have to do with this? Okay, I have a task that I have to do with this. So I'll take that email right out of my inbox and drag it onto my task list. And I'll write down the specifics of what has to be done and by when. Then now that it's on my task list and I know that no matter what, I won't forget this, then I look on my calendar and say, when can I actually carve out time to do this task? So I'll go and look and say, okay, this is going to take me roughly 2 hours, so I'm going to need to block off either 2 hours at once or 1 hour at a time, which I prefer to do. And then I'll put those two times on my calendar for me to do that. And now I go back to the inbox, and I either file the email if I need to keep it, or I delete it. While my thought is really focused on it, I've touched this email only once. So if you can keep that flow in all the things that you do, I decide what I'm going to do with this piece of paper or electronic information. I put it on my task list, and then I put it on my calendar, and then I either dump it or I file it. I've touched it only once, and now I don't have to worry about it. So that really hits the key items that we talked about in time-saving solutions for managing an electronic office. In a visual component, we were able to do many more hands-on things in the email, but I think for your listening audience, this will really help to give some tools that will help them to save some time and gain that work week back a year.
Well, I think my own interjection with that would be that I'm just thinking about how I'm going to spend my week, because I know that I will, in fact, gain that week a year, and the only question is, where do we spend it? And does that mean we have it with our family, or are we going to go out and prospect and make some more money? Giselle, I couldn't be more appreciative of your input on not only this seminar, but Giselle also did at NPE a seminar on making effective presentations, and there'll be a link to that in the article here as well. If you enjoyed what you heard Giselle talking about here, be sure to check out her presentation audio as well, because it was equally inspiring. Thanks a lot, Giselle, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you so much, Reader. It's been a pleasure.